I should just introduce myself. I think I've met most of you, but my name is Pat Hayden, and I live in Washington, D.C., and I have some assumptions, I guess, about lay people in the church, that they ought to be involved in the education of the church, that we have as much insight and intelligence and ability to articulate things as the clergy do. And so this is a little bit of an effort to kind of live out that assumption. I am a non-degree student at Wesley Theological Seminary, and it was as a result of being at the seminary that I had the opportunity this past summer, just before I came to Holden, to take a two-week intensive course on the church in South Africa. We met 9 to 12 every day for 2 weeks, and our instructor was a Dr. John DeGrucci, who is a South African, fourth generation, white, religion professor at the University of Cape Town, who has been involved professionally and personally in the anti-apartheid struggle for the better part of the last 16 years, and before that with his life, I mean, in his family and such, his wife and three children involved too. He is in this country to do a sabbatical semester at Bethel College in Newton, Kansas, and hopefully will produce from that a book on the history of the church in South Africa. So what we got in two concentrated weeks, I think, was the beginning of the research for this book. I do want to declare sort of at the outset that this is tremendously oversimplified and suffers from the limitations of both my ignorance and trying to condense 2 weeks worth of school into one 30-minute session. So kind of take all of that with a grain of salt, if you will. I hope that we'll have time after I finish talking for you to ask questions, and I would invite you to do that for two reasons. One, if I know the answers, I'll be glad to tell you. If I don't, it'll give me stuff to look up, because I really think that the relationship between the U.S. church and the church in South Africa is a very important one, and I'd like to see some dialogue get started there. I think we could both benefit enormously. So let me just go over some really simple-minded stuff, but important stuff. South Africa refers to the country South Africa, which is at the bottom of the peninsula of the continent of Africa. Southern Africa, when that term is used, includes the country of South Africa and the surrounding countries, which you may not be able to see very well on this map. Namibia, or formerly Southwest Africa, Botswana, which is immediately above South Africa, Rhodesia, or Zimbabwe, which is the liberation name for Rhodesia, which connects, has a common border with South Africa, and Mozambique, which also has a common border. There's a little country in here called Malawi. Angola is not very far away, and neither is Zambia. You know, there are a lot of, and this is an important configuration to remember, primarily economically as well, but also politically. Economically, the ties between South Africa and all the rest of these countries are very, very strong, and they have been set up for years and years and continue despite the sort of political turmoil that is going on in that region. Okay. South Africa has a population of about 25 million people, and it breaks down sort of like this. There are whites, which are primarily British, and Afrikaner, which is the combination of Dutch and German, that comprise 4.5 million of that 25 million population. There are coloreds, which is a technical term in South Africa referring to the product of the intermarriage between the Khoikhoi and the San, which were the indigenous native people of around Cape Town, like our American Indians, who married with the Malaysian slaves and Indians that were brought in. The black South Africans were never slaves in South Africa as such. The slaves were brought from the East, and the intermarriage between the native people, the indigenous Indians, and the Malays produce the people who are known as coloreds. There are 2.5 million coloreds. There's 500,000 Asian people who are Indians and Chinese. And then the majority of the population is black African, and there are 18 million. So the ratio between white and black is about 1 to 4. That's important to keep in mind too. The history of South Africa is almost as old, or is as old, I shouldn't say almost, as the history of the United States. The Dutch first established a trading post in 1652 and have been continuously in occupation of that country since that time, so they regard themselves very much as native people in the same way that we regard this as our country. The blacks who live in South Africa now came down from the Congo and the middle part of Africa somewhere around the 1400s, and by the 1600s were settled along the western coast down into the part that is now Natal and Durban and Lesotho, Swaziland. The English arrived with their military garrisons and such about 1800, and the first colonists arrived about 1820. So the English have been there for 150 some odd years. So this is a country which has a lot of people who, like John de Grucci, are fourth generation South Africans and really regard themselves as Africans. And I had not quite connected with that when he started talking. Somehow, in my ignorance, I thought South Africa was a fairly recent development, and it startled me to realize that it has as much history and complexity as the United States does. Okay. Need to give a definition of apartheid, because I think that's pretty important in this conversation. Apartheid is the Afrikaner word, which means separate, and it defines as government policy a separation of people into ethnic groups that are physically apart from one another. So that the policy of the South African government right now is to carve the country of South Africa up into groupings, some of which are white and some of which are black, completely, with separate governmental structures, so that you have black leaders in government and economic units in the black areas, and you have white leaders in economic units and society and culture in the white areas, and the crossover between those two things is very precisely controlled. So apartheid means separate development. Okay, let's talk about the church in South Africa, which is what we want to do. The biggest church in South Africa is the Dutch Reform Church, which is the church that grew out of the Dutch who went to South Africa in the 1600s. It has about, 2 million members. The next largest church grouping is what is called the English-speaking churches. And these are churches which had their origins in England, would be like the Congregationalists and the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Episcopalians and such. Then there are also Lutherans, Roman Catholics, Pentecostals, and some 3,000 different denominations loosely grouped under something called the African Independent Churches. All of these people make up church populations. Of the 25 million people in South Africa, 13 million, or better than half, belong to a church, consider themselves church people. The majority of Christians in South Africa are black, obviously, but again, a fact which had sort of escaped my head. I guess what's important is to know that the Dutch Reformed Church, which has several subgroupings, is not a state church as such, but functions very much like a state church. In other words, it has a Presbyterian form of government, and most of the leaders in the towns where there are Dutch Reformed churches would be elders of the Dutch Reformed Church. It has more members than any other church in South Africa. Most of the members of parliament and the government leaders are members of the Dutch Reformed Church. Okay, enough said. It's a church which is, I guess it would be fair to say now, as a public policy, lines up really on the side of the government, but has within it a whole lot of people who are concerned about the struggle against apartheid and are fighting that in their own churches. The clergy particularly, but the laity in the Dutch Reformed Church tend to be rather more conservative situation, which is similar in this country, I think, in some respects. Okay. To sort of take a look at the struggle, I'm going to compress time and use a typology which Dr. DeGrucci developed because I think it may be helpful. If there's anything, as I sort of go through this, that isn't clear, would you please stop me? Because I'm not used to doing this, so it would be helpful to know what I'm doing. In 1948, some critical things happened which sort of set the stage for this present situation. The first thing was, much to their great surprise, the Afrikaner Nationalist Party won the election that was held after the war. They did not expect to. They didn't even have a shadow cabinet formed. But they won through a whole lot of combination of circumstances. Their major platform before 1948 had been a strong nationalism to try to separate the country from the control of the British. And in order to try to make try to heal some of the divisiveness that this ardent nationalism caused, they downplayed that issue and picked up the race issue as something to sort of put the whites in South Africa kind of together. And apartheid, which had been simply a slogan meaning separate in the 1948 election, was picked up and made into government policy. In 1948, segregation began on the buses. And through the whole period up to 1960 was a gradual increase growing of the legislation and regulations and policies which separated black people from white people in that country. During this period of time, the primary church response was as individual churches, Dutch Reformed Church, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Roman Catholics, you know, all of those folks, passing resolutions in their synods, in their regional or national bodies, saying that apartheid was not really a very good thing. They did engage in some legislative analysis, but it was a period primarily of not a lot of real church focus in terms of practical struggle on the apartheid thing. That changed rather sharply in about 1960, or actually 1961, after something called the Sharpeville Massacre. Some of you may remember. It was a nonviolent protest in a rural area against some apartheid legislation, and the police panicked with this group of primarily black people coming towards a police station, fired into the crowd and killed 100 folks, mostly women and children. It was an event which inflamed the situation internationally as well as nationally. Resulted in the banning of the African National Party, which was the black party in South Africa, which was both a good move and bad move, I guess, in some sense, because the African National Party went into exile in countries like England and the United States and began to put pressure on those governments to deal with the South African apartheid policy. The church's response to Sharpeville with the World Council was to have a consultation at Cottesloe, which is a place outside of Johannesburg. And the consultation pulled together all of the official representatives of all of the churches in South Africa. They met for a week behind closed doors with no press coverage at all. And at the end of that week, they emerged with a resolution condemning apartheid and calling for some particular relationships between the church and the state, and it was unanimous. That meant that the Dutch Reformed Church and their primary leaders were there, had joined in with all of the other churches to this statement. It caused an enormous outcry in the country. And the Prime Minister, Mr. Voorster, who is still the Prime Minister, through the church and some other organizations which are scattered throughout the country, got the individual churches and lower units of the Dutch Reformed Church to reject this resolution from the Cottesloe consultation. A significant move. It also was the occasion on which the Dutch Reformed Church then pulled out of, pulled out of the South African Council of Churches, which did exist at that point.
What was his intention in convincing them against that?
Well, it was to say that apartheid was the government policy and that the church did not have the right to make some this kind of resolution, and that the Dutch Reformed Church was not going to go along with the church leaders on this issue, but asked the church, the Dutch Reformed Church, to go along with the government policy on this issue. One of the results of that was that the moderator of the Dutch Reformed Church at that point in time was a man named Beyers Naudé, who left his position to found something called the Christian Institute, which was an organization that individuals joined, and it had two purposes. One was to facilitate Afrikaner and English dialogue, and the other was to facilitate black and white dialogue. The Christian Institute was a significant force during this period of 60 to 68 in just raising consciousness about the issues of apartheid. It's also during this period that the church, in kind of prophetic ministry from the government, was asked to set its own house in order. There was one particular incident where a man went to see the prime minister to complain about the inequity of black wage scales of government workers. And the prime minister listened to him and then turned around and said, "And what are the wage scales of the black workers in the church?" And he realized that he didn't have a thing further to say. So the church began to set its own house in order at this point, all of the churches. The Cottesloe consultation was important also because it was the first time it was a time when the ecumenical spirit, the cooperation between churches, really began to emerge and grow. Okay. That brings us up to 1968, which is, I think, a critical year for the South African Church, because it was in that year that something was published called A Message to the People of South Africa, that was a document of the South African Council of Churches. And what it said, in short, I'm going to read you a couple of representative lines. We believe that this doctrine of separation is a false faith, a novel gospel. It inevitably is in conflict with the gospel of Jesus Christ, which offers salvation both individual and social through faith in Christ alone. It is keeping people away from the real knowledge of Christ, and therefore it is the church's duty to enable our people to distinguish between the demands of the South African state and the demands of Christian discipleship. It was a major document and watershed for the church struggle against apartheid in South Africa. And it, again, caused an enormous furor. What happened was that the government came back to the South African Council of Churches and said, "All right, what are your alternatives? If this is what you feel, then, you know, how would you change things?" And the response of the South African Council of Churches to that question was this funny thing called Sprocase, which was a study project where they invited people in several different areas, law, economics, education, social relations, to come together and actually work on alternatives, which would be a multiracial society. It was projects with specific legislative proposals. It was educational programs for the church and for the country. It lasted for about 2 years, extended into another year, and Dr. De Grucci thinks had a significant impact on beginning to rattle some of the foundations of apartheid as a government policy, and certainly helped the church get a lot more clear about what it was doing. In 1971, something called the University Christian Movement was begun, which was the first point at which black theology began to emerge in South Africa, a very radical group which said, in effect, Christianity has been polluted by the white people in this country, and we have a message of liberation for both. I think one of the primary spokespersons for that theology right now is a Lutheran, Dr. Manus Buthelezi, who is head of the Lutheran Church down there, the bishop. A very courageous and prophetic man who doesn't hesitate to speak out on apartheid, but does it in a very redemptive way, does not separate people. Okay, let's see, where does that bring us up to? I just should say that in this period, 68 to 74, is sort of the arena of a whole lot of liberation struggle in Africa, you know, when all kinds of countries were becoming independent. And with this sort of conflict going on around South Africa and pressure in the United Nations and all the rest of it, the country internally was very stretched and pulled to try to stay in touch with the anti-apartheid forces, in touch with each other. In 1972, the government appointed something called the Slavebush Commission to investigate the Christian Institute because of its, what they felt, subversive activities against the state. And as a result of a year's investigation, which a lot of people refused to participate because of the violation of civil rights, the government decided to make the Christian Institute an affected organization, which is a technical term, meaning that it was no longer allowed to receive any money from overseas. And as the Christian Institute had been receiving 90% of its funding from overseas, its program of some 45 staff people and all of these publications just dried up overnight. So it still exists, and there are a couple of people involved in it, but its effectiveness has been diminished enormously. In 1974, a conference was held in South Africa, again sponsored by the Council of Churches, which raised for the first time the conscientious objection issue. Dr. De Grucci sees this as another significant turning point at which the church really began to wrestle with the whole violence, nonviolence debates as a way to foster change in South Africa. And that debate is still going on and is a very live one. You know that in 1976, a riot erupted in Soweto, which is a suburb of Johannesburg, has over 1 million people in it, all black, and was a real confrontation for both the government and the church in terms of what its role would continue to be in this fight. And the primary role of the church there was to be the communicator between the two sides, to be a place where people's words could be trusted, which is a very uncomfortable role. And that's kind of where the church is right now. Can I just wrap that up? And that sort of brings us up to date. Yeah.
Well, I had the feeling or the impression that the Catholic Church was also involved in the apartheid business. And,
yes.
You know, trying to abolish it.
Yes, it is, very much so.
Do you know much about it?
Well, I know just a little bit that all of the statements which the Roman Catholic bishops have issued have been very much in against the apartheid struggle and have been very particular in terms of political and economic and social issues. And that in 1977, what happened was that both the Anglican and the Roman Catholic schools admitted black students a year ago and just never bothered to tell anybody. And after they had been in school for a year, they just said, oh, by the way, you know, we've got some blacks in our schools. And the government was really hoisted in a dilemma. They could, if they closed down those schools, then they would have to provide schools for all these kids, and they're not about to do that. So that issue is kind of still in limbo, but they're going on and doing it.
Did your Paul make any comments to the earlier sensitization of people to the problems by Alan Payton and Crime of a Beloved Country? Now that came before all this, and he was
yes.
Coming out of the Anglican Church, and I think that's where most people first heard, hey, there's something wrong with
that. Yeah. His pen has been very powerful both inside and outside the country.
Very few books written about that.
I think his was really the first voice that was heard outside. I mean, that's what I personally was aware that, hey, nothing's been right in South Africa.
Alan Payton has written two or three other books in addition to Cry of a Beloved Country, which one of which is called, I think, A South African Tragedy is the South African title, and Hoffmeyer is the American title, or it's the other way around, which is a biography of a liberal politician of through the period of 1948. That Dr. De Grucci said was a good sort of summary history. And he's written a couple of other books, which I have the information about and would be glad to share with anyone. Yeah.
My friend, really close friend, lives in Zululand,
yeah.
South Africa, and she says, what's happening to them, her husband and her, they have invited people into their homes, blacks into their homes. Her husband has been made the chief photographer for the king, etc. And now their mail is being opened, their phone is tapped, you know, all this business. And she says what's happening over there is a lot of the blacks are turning to communism because communism allows them into their church, does not have segregated buses, segregated all of this. And she says, what the Christian church says, come, be saved, but you can't come to our church. You can't ride in our buses. You would have to go to a different bathroom for mm-hmm. this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
She says a lot of blacks are, because of that, are turning to communism, which in the beginning offers them equality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's still very true on the local level for a lot of congregations. The South African Council of Churches is not made up of local congregations. It's made up of denominations. And there are many local congregations who are integrated, or at least who arrange for integrated activities. It's very difficult because there are a lot of rules that you have to break, and you have to find places where blacks and whites can get together. And that has to be in private situations.
You know, she was saying, you know, it's against the law.
Yeah.
You know, to do this and that. I mean, there's a law specifically saying, you know, you can't, whatever.
Yeah, you can't, you know, you can't swim together. You know, there are a lot of things, although that some of those things are breaking down, like the especially in sports, the cricket lawns and everything else are now open to whoever pays the money to come in. So, you know, it's a very mixed thing. It is true that Marxism is a very attractive alternative, and he said that is one of the things that is really a serious issue now, because Mozambique, which has a common border with South Africa, is now a Marxist state and a very doctrinaire one.
No, that's fine.
You had a question.
I disagree with you on what you said about the Afrikaner church, the Dutch Reformed church.
Uh-huh.
From what I've read, from what I've seen, they are as guilty or more guilty than the government of South Africa. They support the apartheid 100%. Maybe there's a few radical, low-ranking clergymen mm-hmm. that might be against it, but the rank and file and the ministers of that church believe in something totally different than we do, and they take certain parts of the Bible and take them out of context. They can prove to you where the Bible says they're right.
They're
right in there with them.
Yeah.
They're not... When you say that the Dutch Reform is, you know, kind of with some of the other groups, no, right in there with the government.
Yeah. No, I would have to agree with you to a large extent. There is one section of the Dutch Reformed Church,
probably very small,
which I can't pronounce the Afrikaner, which is really a racist church. I mean, it only allows white members, and you know, is very
that's
particular
whole,
of that. But the other, the NGK, which is the larger Dutch Reformed Church, is really in a state of much turmoil at the moment, because it did develop mission churches for the blacks, for the coloreds, and for the Asians. And these churches, which got very good clergy people, because the NGK insisted on that, are now coming back to the mother church and saying, hey, look, this is the gospel that you taught us, now why don't we practice it? And are really forcing the NGK to do some rethinking and re-theologizing. So you're probably right. I mean, I think you are. But that situation is not monolithic, is what I'm saying, inside the NGK. And it may be more in favor of the government policy, but there are some significant cracks in that armor, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you know how Dr. Lacey is faring now? He was in our home about 4 years ago, and then I know when he went back, he was under house arrest for a year. And then that was lifted, and we saw him again, but then now I'm not aware of how things are with him.
I think that the house arrest thing has been lifted, the ban has been lifted, so that he can travel inside the country and is free to leave the country. It's very unclear exactly how decisions like that get made and by whom. You know, the Bureau of State Security, which is called BOSS, I think that's a lovely name, right, is the South African equivalent of the FBI. And they really are a very sophisticated, if pervasive, security force in the country. And it would probably be them who would make decisions. There is, however, also a security wing to the police, which Dr. DeGrucci says is really much more feared by most people because they don't seem to have any logic to the things they do. Really vocal people will be left alone, and people who are involved in a lesser way are the ones who get zapped. But at the moment, Dr. Buthelezi is free to speak and meet with people and travel.
And he's free to come here again?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think he's coming over to this country, or came over in the spring to get an honorary degree or something or other, and meet with people in New York and Geneva on the way back. Yeah.
How much is the American Church in the field of mission, or if at all, in touch or involved, whatever, with this place, this very delicate issue?
I don't know. That's one of the questions I'd like to find out. I really
because
don't know.
Because this is something, what you're talking about is somebody from Africa. This is not connected with our mission, is it?
No, but I can make a comment about that in a way. We have one of our theology professors, Texas Lutheran Roy Endquist, who was in South Africa for 2 years as a professor in the seminary in Williamsburg, and he just came back in January. So Roy and Mia did spend 2 weeks in South Africa. Now, in this sense, they were representing the American Lutheran Church, but this was a cooperative thing. Mark, you helped me out on some of the details. I think it was also LCA involved in there or something. It was not just there was an LPA person who was going to go, and somebody had a visa in New York, so Roy filled in or something. So it's sort of a cooperative mission, safe from there, and sort of a Lutheran approach that is involved. Now, it's not a mission. Now, this was a seminary which was started by German people, so primarily.
I know a lot, at least I've heard a lot over the years on Madagascar. Is that something quite separate?
Yeah. The people in Madagascar are the French. That's an entirely different situation. They are not
in
the same way at all. It's an entirely different ethnic. It's a separate thing. But I did want to comment on the experience of Roy and Mia also in relation to this. Mia taught at a girls' school. Now, this was for white girls. It was a private school. And she found out, and also they found out in any social grouping that the people there, I mean the South African white people, that the one topic you don't discuss, you seem to be very much afraid to discuss it in any kind of social group. And so as Mia got to know her students, she tried very subtly to find out, you know, how they felt about it. And she found out that they were not really aware of what was going on. Apparently it's the kind of thing that people are afraid to touch in their church life or in anything. You know, it's like you're closing your eyes to the situation. And I guess subtly, in her own way, she took some chances and talked to them and sort of tried to open her eyes a little bit about, hey, let's see what's happening here. And she had some feedback where some girl would say, well, I was in Johannesburg, in the city shopping, where the blacks may go shopping freely during certain hours. And here was a black person in front of me, and ordinarily, the white person would still go ahead in the line. But this girl said, you know, I thought about that person as a human being and let him or her go first. So that a lot of the people had not really faced the issue. That was one impression of the Inquist, I think. That they just almost an ostrich-like kind of thing. The problem is so big, you'd just rather not look at it.
Well, it is true, and I think that was one of the things which the Sprokas tried to touch, you know, the study project from 1968 to 72. And these are study aids which have been prepared to go with those materials and are available to all the member churches of the South African Council. Some of the publications of Sprokas after they came out were banned, which means that you're not allowed to buy them or to give them to anybody. You're allowed to possess them, but you may not transfer them. John says you develop really ingenious ways of making sure that everybody gets a copy of something before the government machinery takes the 3 or 4 days to ban something when it's been published.
Well, there was a press that was run by Eastern World Federation money, I think, it was bought, which was
yes.
destroyed.
Yes.
Some of that was lazy, things were being published on that. And now somehow or the other has gotten another press together, but now just who did that? You see, it's very hard to pin that down, but there seems to be an explosion in the print shop or something. And very definitely.
I wonder too how their communication is. I mean, I really don't know. I'm sure they don't hear everything at one time. They're such a big country too.
Mm-hmm. And communication among whom?
Among the people. Are they, how much are they informed? And you know, I think there are a lot of obstacles I could see. We can't compared by any means with our country here.
Well, anyone who's been to Johannesburg says it's a beautiful, sophisticated city. I mean,
but that's not all Africa.
Right, so I mean, right. But you see, that's where most of the action is.
It is primarily, I think, in South Africa. The government exists both in Cape Town, which is on the eastern Cape, and in Pretoria, which is up close to Johannesburg. So I think they have a fairly sophisticated press establishment. The Council of Churches has grown from 3 staff members in 1968 to a 6-story building and 45 staff members and such in 1977. So it is acting as a primary communication and program vehicle for the church struggle in that country against apartheid. It has a program which provides maintenance, physical maintenance support for the families of political detainees, and they handle enormous sums of money each month, you know, as one example. Yeah.
If the American missionaries, if they say anything to anti-government, how do you put it like that? They cannot say it, or they'll just be out. So they better just keep their mouth shut and do what they can, because if they open their mouth too much, they're out.
Mm-hmm.
Now the black press is like, if they say too much, they'll have an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to say it very subtly, or that they can ban it when they say it.
Yeah. It is true that certainly the government was very quick to round up all the leaders of the Soweto riot. Part of what bothered the government was that they hadn't identified the leaders in the first place. I mean, most of the informers in South Africa are black, but the government didn't know who the people were who sparked off the Soweto riot, and it took them a while to figure that out. So that the leadership in the black community on that level has had to remain very fluid, you know, with people emerging and then other people emerging, because if the government targets it, then they pretty quickly remove those people from the scene.
They have an act called the Anti-Communism Act,
yeah,
which enables them to detain anybody for as long as they want.
Mm-hmm.
The police can arrest someone and put them in jail,
mm-hmm,
and never bring them before a judge.
Mm-hmm. One of the tactics then of the church, of the South African church, is to make very clear that when one person is arrested, it's the whole Christian community that's involved in that arrest, so that they do not allow the government to isolate an individual so that he or she can disappear. And there really is quite a machinery of response when they find that somebody has been picked up. Somebody asked Dr. DeGrucci at the end of the course if he could gaze into his crystal ball over the next 5 years, and he said that he couldn't, that there were only 3 things that were really certain, or 4 things actually. One is that change was going to continue, that there was going to be a lot of violence involved in the change, that after whatever happened, there would be black and white that would have to put the pieces together in some configuration. And the final thing was that the church had a critical role to play in terms of helping people communicate with each other across the whole spectrum of those who are against apartheid and those who are not sensitive to it, those who are against apartheid but in favor of protecting the borders. Border war is very much a current problem for the South African government.
Yeah. In April or May, I think, we had one of the black Lutheran bishops from South Africa as a visitor guest on our campus. And I think he was from Namibia. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he was speaking in such a peaceful way in terms of that the Spirit of Christ must rule us, and that he could not see violence. But I was almost disturbed. In other words, I the strangest feeling came through my mind that almost is what a lot of black people would call an Uncle Tomism.
Hmm.
I was almost appalled that I didn't see more righteous indignation in this man. And yet, he was such a beautiful person from the viewpoint of the peace of God ruling in his heart and life. You know, that he was so forgiving that I thought, man, you are more forgiving in the situation and I can be out of the
mm-hmm,
situation.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really
remarkable.
True.
I mean, I had the strangest feeling. I thought, how can he be that calm and that peaceful and that loving
mm-hmm.
in this situation?
Sounds like Mahatma Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the same. It's the same way as who is in. Who's the man in Zimbabwe who Ian Smith threw in jail for 7 years? Joseph Nkomo? Is he one of the?
No, that's
I can't remember the but the man who was a black leader of the South African, I mean one of the nationalist forces in Zimbabwe. And he has been sitting with Ian Smith, and when asked, did he forgive this man, he said, yes, he did. There really is a tremendous amount, I think, for us to learn about the nature of nonviolence as a redemptive force in that situation. No, I didn't. One of the things which startled me a whole lot as a result of this course, and I can't give you too many specifics, which I'd like to try to get, is that I got the very clear impression that the South African church, in its struggle with the apartheid policy of the government and the whole question of multiracialism, is a lot farther down the pike in terms of a pluralistic society than the United States is. And precisely because there are so many pressures against it to keep it separate, that they really are living in some very radical ways, a kind of new Christianity that make us, or should, made me embarrassed about the state of our own lack of church integration. I mean, how many of our local congregations are integrated significantly? What kind of multiracialism really exists through and through? Is there a black theology which informs our life as much as the white theology?
Are you telling that our churches are not open to different?
No, I'm not saying that they're not. I'm saying that if you look at them, if you look at the patterns of living and economic integration, if you look at sort of multiracialism in this country, and look at multiracialism in South Africa, trying for the moment to set aside all of the laws, that you probably find very similar situations. But with the church struggling harder for that kind of multiracialism than the church in this country.
In the same way, we say we can't see anything while talking with our hands over our eyes. We just, willingly ignore so much, we'll try to ignore so much. I mean, probably even more so 10 years ago, right here in America. I mean, you can, not to that extent that it's in South Africa, but still. Such as so much that we just choose not to see. Like something she brought this morning here in Poland. What type of cultural, ethnic blend do we really bring in here? Not that happens to come, but that we really try to reach out with the ministry and bring in.
You got to remember that in our country, that churches are very ethnic. Like
but should they be?
They are in South Africa too. I mean, the Lutherans are primarily German, and the Dutch Reformed Church is primarily Afrikaner. The English-speaking churches are primarily English people. I mean, it was fascinating to me that Dr. De Groot, she said, when the South African Council of Churches issues a publication, it issues it in 8 languages. When you have any kind of gathering of the churches in that country, you have a minimum of 4 languages, and you can sing hymns in all 4 at the same time. And you speak, and as long as you have a translator, you can use any language. I mean, it seems to me they have a kind of pluralism there, which they're trying to work with in a very rich way. That's a significant issue right now. But part of what this message to the South African people says is that ethnic identity is not one of the criteria for being part of the Christian community of faith, because it's ethnic identity that is at the root of the apartheid policy. Whether it's Afrikaner identity or black identity or colored or English or whatever. So that's to say that I don't think, even though our churches are ethnic, that should be any excuse for us not. No.
I mean, like how many, say, for example, Polish Lutherans do you know?
Why should you have to talk about a Polish Lutheran, though? Why should you have to talk about a Scandinavian Lutheran?
I'm not talking about Lutheran.
You know why? Well, yeah.
Our churches are ethnic.
Mm-hmm.
Just like there's not very many.
A lot of times we can hide behind that shadow.
Yeah, that may be an accurate description, but I'm wondering if that is something that really is part of the kingdom of God.
The ethnicity sometimes becomes more important than the central Christian identity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's more cultural than it is basically Christian.
But I think in recent years, people have different denominations have certainly worked together. You have that in Seattle. And I don't feel that maybe I'm ignorant, maybe I'm not informed. I don't really feel this. I think it's people's choice. I don't think we really keep that close, not where I come from. Maybe I'm not sensitive enough to that. Is it really that bad? Are we really that close? I know, I realize that your whole is not a good representation of all America. That is true, you know. But then I don't think we turn somebody down if they want to come.
Mm-hmm.
Do we? I don't think so.
No.
At the University of Minnesota, you have to take a human relations course in order to be a teacher. And I think that's true probably in every state and union now. And any teachers know that. That textbook in Minnesota is The Nature of Prejudice. And throughout the book, the statistics are stacked in such a way to really be very convincing, very, very persuasive on the idea that any minority group will feel more uncomfortable in the Christian church than any place else that they should happen to try to get in. That's a pretty sweeping statement, but that's the theme of the book.
Wow. We have our homework cut out for us, then. I guess part of what I wanted to do tonight, and I'll just make it explicit, was one of the things the course did for me was to provide a moderate view of the situation in South Africa. It seems to me that it's pretty easy for us to get, through our press, the black radical view in South Africa because of the exiles, because of the people who've been forced to leave that country. And it's also pretty easy for us to get the government policy view. But those are the extremes. And I really think that we need to find ways to get in touch with and stay in touch with the moderate view, the people for whom this is a daily issue and struggle and has been since 1948 in a particularly conscious way, and have developed all sorts of resources which could illumine our own understanding and in fact make our support of that multiracial effort in South Africa a lot more effective than it is right now. There are some publications that churches could subscribe to. You know, there are some books for a good library. It would be interesting to hear from you some ideas of what kinds of resources the church might develop in terms of people or other things, so that this moderate viewpoint has a chance to inform us in the United States. Because I, for one, you know, I think I thought it was there, but I didn't know it was there, and I didn't know how to get in touch with it, and how to let it help me really get serious about the issue in South Africa. You know, if Jimmy Carter's supporting human rights, and, you know, we believe in Andy Young, why, seems to me we need to get behind that with some substance instead of just rah-rah. And there's some things here we can use.
In our own country, there's a lot of American companies, big companies, that are dealing with South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Polaroid Land Company makes passports which they must, African must carry at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an American company who's actively supporting the core of apartheid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one area where Dr. DeGrucci felt an enormous amount could be done in the United States, because the issue, he says, of the South African law, the apartheid law, is really a red herring, he feels, that most American companies, when confronted with that, will say, well, the law in South Africa doesn't let us do this. And his question back to them is, have you really tested that law? Is that really a law, or is that your interpretation of it? He said, for instance, there is no law on the book that legislates discrimination of wages between blacks and whites. There is a practice. It is the custom to discriminate. But there is no law that forbids blacks being paid the same amount as whites, in fact, being paid more to compensate for things like housing and pensions and other sorts of things. There is no law which speaks to the presence of blacks in the whole hierarchy of management positions.
But how realistic is that if you're going to make a corporation do something like that? We can't make it do anything here to do it, you know. If it's profitable for them to do it, why should they not do it?
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's right or wrong is very irrelevant.
I think if it's publicized in the press what Polaroid is doing down there,
I think
that would cause economic problems for Polaroid right here in this country, which would make them do it. I mean, when they're losing money,
not only publicity, but really us doing our homework. Here, both for the corporations here and in connection with people in South Africa, and just asking them point blank questions about how they are investing in the future of South Africa. It's very clear that there is going to be majority rule in South Africa, black majority rule. What's unclear is what that rule is going to look like, whether it's going to be socialist, progressive, Marxist, cataclysmic, whatever. And I would think that the issue of self-interest could be appealed to, that if Polaroid wants a stake in the future, that they should begin to develop policies within the company which support the multiracial efforts rather than undermine them, you know, in addition to the press
also,
campaigns.
Also, the women in this country have diamonds on their fingers. I wonder how many would actually wear them if they knew the conditions of the workers in the diamond mines and the wages they were being paid to get those diamonds out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The wages even now are 1/20th for a black mine worker what they are for a white mine worker. So that if a black mine worker gets 50 rand, which is the equivalent to $60 a month, a white mine worker would get about 300 rand.
Very hard to know sometimes about some of those decisions. For example, the whole business of the Krugerrand. There was a wide advertising campaign throughout the country, you know, selling these pretty gold coins. And of course, gold coins are big items and things like that. In our area, they were advertised on television. Finally, a group in San Antonio got it together and did some protesting and things like that. Know that now, if you discourage people from buying those coins, are you really, you know, does that make any difference at all? Yesterday, in looking at the Christian Science Monitor, which I think is a very well-balanced publication, I was a little startled, however, to see an ad from the South African for selling the South African Krugerrand in a pendant kind of thing. In other words, the Christian Science Monitor accepted that ad. Okay, now, if somebody here writes a letter of protest to the Christian Science Monitor, what are you doing accepting an ad from a government that is a racist government? I mean, is that directly related to the issue? That's one of my problems in terms of, you know, how directly does that go to the issue?
Mm-hmm.
Are you hurting many other innocent people? I mean, does that really speak to the point? And that's where I'm hung up.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very, very central question, Evelyn, because I think that we have tended in the United States to choose easy things like that, to protest the racist policies in South Africa. You know, I myself have been guilty of sort of blithely signing positions, you know, petitions calling for the economic withdrawal of all U.S. companies from South Africa. And I've decided that that's an irresponsible position only because it doesn't really take the issue seriously. It doesn't force me to do my work about what the impact of that is on that country and whether or not that's an effective Christian witness. It seems to me that if we are the church in this country, then we are the church in solidarity with the church in South Africa, and that what affects them affects us, and that when, therefore, we take actions, they should be taken with the same concern for life and health and support and wholeness and salvation that we would give to our own selves in the church here. And that sort of blanket rejection of things, I don't think is a very thoughtful policy.
The United States, large corporations are dealing with South Africa. The Russians are supplying the guerrillas with arms, ammunition, food, money, etc. Now, when the revolutionaries eventually do win, what are they going to think of the United States and the American Christians and the Christian Church as a whole for supporting the racist policy all the time?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I think that the church in this country needs to get very clear about who it is supporting. I mean, I think that that we have the opportunity through something like the South African Council of Churches and through our own local denominations to support those efforts, both white and black, in South Africa that are really working for responsible change. It's possible that the guerrillas will win. It's also possible that the black people who win will be moderate black people. I mean, you know, that's as much a possibility as the guerrillas winning. But they are going to win. The guerrillas have a better chance of winning, it seems to me, if we don't put our weight on the side of those moderate forces. You know, there is, for instance, one of the things that the blacks in South Africa are trying to do is develop a whole economic infrastructure which allows them some clout to respond, you know, to the Afrikaner economic structure. There is a black bank, the National Bank of South Africa or something. It seems to me that there is a lot that we could do to put our weight on the side of peaceful change in that country. But it means we have to do our own homework. And this is a small step in that direction. Well, it may not be, but I think it's also, to me, fairly clear that the church, while not being able ever to opt out of the world and all the violence that is contained therein, cannot use violence as a method for change.
You cannot support violence. I agree with that.
Well, it can't support violence, depending on what you mean by that. It can support people who may use violent means without condoning their violence.
Didn't the World Council of Churches give some money to the South African Liberation Movement a couple years ago?
Yes, the program to combat racism was a very tense situation for South Africa, anti-apartheid forces. Because as far as the South African whites, many were concerned, that was a program to support racism when the World Council of Churches gave money to the guerrilla movement. And it was very hard for the South African churches to be able to say to the World Council, hey, look, you know, you're dividing and conquering internally here, and we disagree with your program, but we agree with the, you know, with the program to combat racism. We just disagree with the money payments to the liberation guerrilla forces. But violence is a real issue, and that one's got to be thrashed through. There aren't any simple answers. I mean, you can't, the violence of Soweto, you know, much of what was destroyed in that riot were the amenities that the government and other people had, and that community itself had been trying to put together, like libraries and daycare centers and all those sorts of things. You know, that you can't condone that violence, and yet you certainly can understand where it comes from.
See, well, the Christians are praying about it. The Russians are giving them guns.
Yeah, but the Christians in South Africa are doing a lot more than just praying about it. You know, I would be glad to share with you some more specific stuff.
The World Federation that, definitely is in there pitching.
Yeah.
In terms of praying.
I'm not sure that the church outside of South Africa is doing more than praying about it. I'm very sure, after this course, that the church in South Africa is doing a whole lot about it. But I'm not sure that those of us who call ourselves Christian outside that country are doing more than praying.
God, it's very hard to know how to go about it.
Yes,
except
it is.
That we can support the international work of groups like,
mm-hmm.
you know, where our church reaches out.
Mm-hmm.
Where we individually may not be able to, but we can say, right on, get in there, do something.
Yeah, and I think there are some things that our individual churches can do. I mean, I think there are some.
I mean, those people sometimes are much closer to the scene. They're informing back and forth. They have. So, I mean, that's one way of being involved, not the most satisfying way.
Mm-hmm. I do, you know, I do have some publications and some ideas and such, and would be glad to talk with them. How are we doing on time? If folks need to go to get freshened up for Vespers or whatever, you're free to do that.